Welcome into this edition of Golf Chow Podcast with Rex and Lab. And folks, we are obviously going to be getting into LIV Golf's No Good, Very Bad Week. But first, what a compelling final hour at the RBC Heritage. Matt Fitzpatrick hit one of the best shots of his career, 4-iron to 13 feet in the playoff to defeat Scottie Scheffler and win the RBC Heritage for his second victory in a month. Rex, you are out there. You and I are both playing hurt, I should probably add at this point. I'm a little nasally, got a little bit of congestion. Sinuses are absolutely on fire. You have been talking nonstop for essentially the past 2 weeks with the Masters and the RBC Heritage, with all the other LIV Golf news that also dropped over the past week. But it actually hurts to talk. Would you like to explain?
It doesn't hurt to talk. It hurts, weirdly enough, to eat. It hurts to drink coffee. I'm not quite sure why. I came down with
sensitivity,
a
sensitivity. That's why.
It's a cracked tooth, according to my dentist. My dentist is Sam Ryder's dad. So I think that's authority. So, and I reached out, and luckily I have an emergency appointment with him tomorrow morning to get it all patched up. But yes, it's been a bit of a painful week. But you dealing with, if you remember correctly, longtime listeners of the pod will remember that I struggled through something very, very similar to that at the Players Championship. We should get a sponsorship for the pod, maybe Zyrtec.
Zyrtec, Allegra, sure. Flonase, if you're listening, I'm in dire straits. It has not rained in Ponte Vedra for about 3 weeks, and I'm absolutely dying here. You were out there, Rex. The vibe was immense. A lot of spring breakers, great turnout, as always, at Harbortown for the RBC Heritage, a signature event on the PGA Tour. What was it like to be out there for, again, it was a little bit of a snooze for 3 hours, and all of a sudden, the fans sensed that a rally was imminent from one Scottie Scheffler, and all of a sudden, it became pretty compelling.
There's so much energy on this island, period. And during this time of year, it's spring break. I think it would probably be this way anyway. But having the tournament here, having it being a signature event, having these players in the mix where you have Scottie Scheffler and you have Matt Fitzpatrick trying to win for the second time, I think there's a level of excitement that, and I had a chance to talk with Maverick McNealy about another story, and we're going to get into LIV Golf and what transpired over the course of the last 7 days with them. But I was talking with Mav about the future of the PGA Tour schedule. And we continue to lean into the idea, Brian Rolapp, the CEO of the PGA Tour, continues to lean into the idea that they want the best players together at the best venues and the biggest markets. And I get that. I understand from a business model, that seems like the best case scenario. To be fair, I've never heard anyone at the PGA Tour, from Brian Rolapp all the way down, say that maybe Hilton Head's not in their future, because it's an iconic venue, and that's the out right there. That's the clause that's going to keep your Harbor Towns and your Pebble Beaches in the mix, because what we saw over the last 4 days, it was really special. Not only is it an amazing golf course, and you have to give complete, just a monsoon of credit to Davis Love and his team for what they didn't do with this golf course. And they were really easy. They were really quick to saying it was just a restoration, that he didn't come in, he didn't try to give it a facelift, didn't try to turn
nip, a little
something.
Tuck.
And I reported earlier in the week that if you were really looking, the only thing that your average golfer, you and I, would probably see is the range is better. Huh, yeah, the range looks cool. Yeah, they did some neat stuff there, because by and large, it was just these little things, these little tweaks specifically for this week. And the tour players saw it, and the tour players were certainly impacted by it to a certain degree. But you're right, the energy here was amazing. And I think it has everything to do with the fact that this is one of those iconic venues. It is a small market. It's a tiny little market, but it's an iconic venue. And it always seems to produce, well, playoffs more often than not is what it feels like. But it always seems to produce excitement coming down the stretch. You're right. After the 72nd hole, it felt like, oh, this could go on forever, because it is a brutal hole. The winds were howling. It was by far the toughest day conditions-wise at Harbortown Golf Links. And for Fitz to pull off that shot, and not only for him to pull it off, I think he had 203 yards in on the first playoff hole, 4-iron, as you pointed out, hit it to about 10 or 15 feet behind the hole. To give you an idea how difficult that shot was, Scottie Scheffler probably came up 2 clubs short. One of the, I would argue, the preeminent ball striker of this generation either misjudged the wind, either missed club, Teddy got it wrong, or simply wasn't able to execute the shot. I'm still not quite sure which one of those things it is. But I think it speaks to how cool it was that Fitz was able to pull it off.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. And I want to get into to Matt Fitzpatrick. Just to go back to something that you were talking about with the market and how great the atmosphere was and the quality of the golf course, I do think there's an important distinction to be made. And obviously, when you look at the markets that the PGA Tour is playing in, they are in less than 50% of the top 10 markets, media markets in the U.S. And if you were Brian Rollup, if you're the future competitions committee, yeah, you should certainly look into that and, you know, try to... I don't know, sort of ride the wave of momentum or go to where the eyeballs already exist. I totally understand that from a business perspective. But with you looking at that, Rex, and you're looking at New York City, you're looking at Boston, you're looking at Chicago, Philadelphia, obviously you already have a tournament in Los Angeles. There's also, yes, the population is immense. You also have way more to do. And that's not necessarily just because you're in a major media market. It's not necessarily going to translate to all of a sudden you're going to have this great crowd on hand. You're going to have 40, 50,000 rabid fans who are devouring the PGA Tour product. I don't think that's necessarily going to be the case. I think later this year, the Travelers Championship is going to be a great litmus test because historically, traditionally, that golf course at TPC River Highlands, no one would mistake it for one of the best courses on the PGA Tour schedule. But the turnout and the fan involvement and the charity component and how well run the tournament is one of the best on the PGA Tour. There still should be a spot on the future PGA Tour for tournaments like the Travelers Championship and obviously tournaments like the RBC. And so I think there's an important distinction to be made that what the PGA Tour should really be focusing on, yes, markets to an extent, the quality of the golf courses and making sure that the best players in the world are going to the best courses that the PGA Tour can possibly have on the schedule, I think is the best strategy. And I think this final round in particular proved that in the right conditions, this is an elite PGA Tour venue, like top three, top five golf course that these guys play all year long. Great crowds. The greens, as you mentioned, had been restored, but this was like the ideal firmness to the point that guys were having a really difficult time even holding the greens from the first cut with wedges. You have to play the angles. You have to be positioned properly. The closely mown areas around the green provide a lot of options. And then you throw in swirling 20-mile-an-hour winds, even stronger when you get out on those first, those last four holes of the golf course. I mean, you saw, Rex, the 18th hole at Harbortown is about 80 yards wide. And you had players nearly driving it out of bounds because it was going so hard in and off the left. It's such a great golf course, the shot making, the shot quality, ball strikers always rise to the challenge. It's nervy down the stretch. To me, that is the prototypical golf course that the PGA Tour players should be tested on. I think the final round was a perfect indication of that.
I'm thanking my lucky stars right now that we actually don't have a producer in our ear, because if it was Chloe or Harris or someone else, they'd be screaming at us, get back on topic. It's the RBC Rap. Heritage.
Rap. Fitz wins. Scotty loses. Live.
And that was amazing, and I do want to get into it. But to your point, talking with Matt McNeely, who is on the board for both the PGA Tour Enterprises and the PGA Tour, he made a point of because I was asking him about the LIV news this week, and he kind of dovetailed what Brian Rollup said early in the week on Trey Wingo's podcast, that they're focused on their product. And Matt took it a step further, saying that, take a look at this event. Take a look at the crowd. Take a look at the leaderboard. Take a look at the attention that it has garnered, not here in the community, but really nationwide. And I think that shows you what you're trying to get to your point. I think you make an excellent point. And the idea is, and like, look, this was the one really interesting thing that Mav told me, is everyone is waiting for this huge makeover of the PGA Tour schedule. Everyone is waiting for this huge change. And he goes, it feels like we are at where we need to be. To paraphrase in a very bad way of what Mav said, like, it seems like
that's not the quote that I read on golfchannel.com.
But where they are right now is a very good product, and I think everyone is coming around to that. And does it need some nips and some tucks? Absolutely. Does it need to be cleaned up a little bit around the edges? Do you need to maybe work into one or two or three extra bigger markets? Absolutely. I mean, that's really what Brian Rollup and his team is trying to do. But this is a perfect example of Hilton Head is a small community, and this tournament means the world to him. But I will point to the work that tournament director Steve Wilmot and his team have done over the years. There was a time when this tournament didn't have a sponsor, when it seemed like it might go away.
And now look at it. It is one of the absolute best on the PGA Tour, not just from a golf course standpoint, from a charity standpoint. It's a signature event. I think this is a perfect testament to where the PGA Tour needs to be. And this isn't a huge revolution. This isn't a huge makeover. So I do think that's telling.
Yeah, and just to bring this full circle and just the symmetry here, if you were now a part of that future competitions committee like Maverick McNealy is, and I encourage everybody to go to golfjournal.com to read his comments in full. You want to go full Davis Love restoration team. For what he did at Harbortown, that's what these guys should now be doing as it relates to the PGA Tour schedule. Could it be improved? Sure. I think getting away at least slightly from the NFL playoffs at the start of the year makes sense. I do think having a bigger, bolder start to the season makes a lot of sense as well, as instead of sort of the laid back vibe that the
having a more has. An easily more more digestible finish as well.
Like, for sure,
all of these the things
post,
are,
yeah. The postseason end with a bang. Totally get it. You look at this stretch of the season. I mean, the RBC Heritage was one of three signature events between the Masters and the year's second major of the PGA Championship. Guys are going to be gassed by the time the U.S. Open rolls around. I get it. All of those things. Those recs, to use one of your phrases, are nips and tucks to what the PGA Tour schedule is and what it can be. I don't think necessarily a revolution or a full-blown blowing up of the product is in order, just like Davis Love and his team did not do so at Harbortown. Let's talk about Matt Fitzpatrick, because he did win the golf tournament. He also won the Valspar Championship in March. He's playing the best golf of his career. I believe he has now moved up to number three in the world rankings, of course, a career high behind just Scottie Scheffler and Roy McIlroy. I was captivated, Rex, by this final round because Matt Fitzpatrick did not make a birdie after the third hole until the playoff. It really looked like he was completely flying on that front nine. And you were out there for Saturday. It was very, very shaky. Then he steadied himself on the back nine in the third round, chipped in for eagle. All of a sudden, he had a three-shot lead heading into the final round. Sort of, this was the complete opposite. Started well, did not miss a shot on the front nine. Then it seemed like he was hanging on for dear life, was getting out of position, misjudging some of the wind gusts. To me, he showed a lot of grit. What did you talk to him about afterward? What did he tell you?
We always do this where you and I both, where if you have a chance to interview the winner, and it's a small window, you only get three, maybe four questions. If you're lucky, what did you really want to know? And the first thing I asked him, this is second playoff, second win, but how did this one feel different? He won a playoff the first time he won the RBC Heritage. And I think what I was
against
trying
Jordan
to get,
Spieth, by the way.
And I think what I was trying to get to there, and I think what he picked up on and talked about, is he's such a different player now than he was just even a few years ago, even since last year. He'll talk about it. I think he's probably reinvented himself at least twice over the course of his career, where there's such an ebb and flow to his career, where getting to that U.S. Open victory at Brookline, you can sit and talk about all of the things that he did to transform not just his game, but his body and his mentality and everything else he did. Kind of went through a very similar transformation. And I would argue that Phil Kenyon was sort of the biggest part of this piece of the puzzle, because he really had to figure out from a putting perspective, how do I turn this sublime ball striking? Because, he is right now second only to Roy McIlroy on the PGA Tour in strokes gained tee to green. He is by far one of the best ball strikers in the game. He needed the short game to catch up. And I think it certainly he did. Now, there was some leaking of the oil, and I think you saw that on the back nine on Sunday afternoon. And certainly the way he played coming down the stretch, not being able to get up and down on the 18, it was just a sloppy bogey. I mean, there's no other way of saying it. Sometimes it's a hard hole. Under those conditions, it was a really hard hole. But that was a sloppy bogey. When you consider that Scottie Scheffler had
550-yard par four into
Scottie Scheffler had just hit the exact same chip shot, almost chipped it in, and he hit it to tap in range. It was absolutely no stress whatsoever. He left it in the absolute perfect spot, sort of a little deep, just right of the green. You had nothing but green to work with. You get it to that shelf and let it feed down. It is not that difficult. And I guarantee you, if Matt was on this podcast right now, he'd be like, yeah, I just didn't execute that one. It was a sloppy bogey, as opposed to, I saw plenty of real good bogeys on 18 over the last few days. But you're right. You talk about him being third in the world. I thought our colleague Jaime Diaz brought up a brilliant point last week at the Masters, talking about Rory on his way to victory at the Masters. And the fun part about this is now all of a sudden we talk about this really cool rivalry between Rory and Scottie Scheffler. I don't know that Fitz is that far out of it, because I think if you put him on the right golf course under the right conditions, look what he did at the Players' Championship.
And then to bounce back from that almost completely unscathed, no scar tissue whatsoever. Just realize that Cameron Young just hit the drive of the century on that final hole. Like, look, man, I just got beat. That one's hard to get by. Wins a couple weeks later. Now does it again at a signature event, as we pointed out, on an iconic golf course. It is a 1, 2, and 3 in the game right now. I truly believe that.
Yeah, I don't know that we have a rivalry, and I would still put Cam Young in that conversation. Another close call at the Masters where he was in the final group as well. I'm just so impressed with the continual reinvention of Matt Fitzpatrick as a player. He was always, I think when he first came out, sort of this scrappy player. He would get hot with the flat stick, but it was, you know, the ball striking was a little bit shoddy. Then he went through the power revolution that helped power his way to the U.S. Open at Brookline back in 2022. You even look at where Matt Fitzpatrick was from a ball striking standpoint at this time last year, one of the lowest points of his career, 75th in the world ranking, his approach play numbers. He was losing strokes to the field, which again, for an elite player, is unheard of. The changes that he's made with his swing and his setup, his iron play in particular with Mark Blackburn. You mentioned sort of the pep talk he had with Phil Kenyon. This has been, at least to this point, statistically the worst putting season of Matt Fitzpatrick's career while he was squandering all of the great ball striking. So the pep talk that he had with Phil Kenyon after a disappointing Masters where he finished just barely inside the top 20 has already paid off as well. You look at what he does well now, Rex, driving the golf ball on a rope with the improved iron play, really tightening up his targets, tightening up his dispersion, just allowing himself to be more aggressive. And with great iron play, he's also then leaving himself, if he does miss greens, and you were going to miss greens at a difficult golf course like Harbortown, just in better spots to get up and down. And yeah, he may have stubbed the one on 18 in regulation, chipping back into the green. That sort of thing is going to happen. Other than that, though, he was outstanding scrambling with, again, a little bit of reinvention with the cross-handed chipping. Since you were out there, Rex, I'm very curious. Over the past, over the last hour of this golf tournament, it was very clearly pro-Scotty, anti-Fitz. And I guess that wasn't all that surprising because Scotty Scheffler is the world number one dominant figure, going to go down as a historical great. This was, at least until the final hour, a pretty sleepy final round with no one making a rally. I totally get it. We also saw this, though, about a month ago at the Players' Championship. Do you think it was at all over the line with some of the fan behavior and some of the abuse that Matt Fitzpatrick seemed to be taking?
No, but I think a lot of times we hear about this secondhand. It could have been something that happened on the 11th tee box as he was walking off that could have been disturbing. And look, fans they've been empowered over the last few years. This isn't Beth Page by any stretch of the imagination. We're not running into that situation where I believe that was truly rock bottom when it comes to fan behavior. However, there are things being said now. And like, look, this is a party spot and they're selling a lot of drinks out there. And everyone was overserved by the time they were coming down the stretch. So I'm not going to be surprised if, as we unpack this over the next few weeks or days, whatever the case may be, if something was said that crossed the line, just like it was said at TPC Sawgrass. I think that's the time and age we live in right now, where the fans in every sporting event just feel empowered. They paid their share. They want to sit there and they want to speak their minds. And sometimes they go over the line. I always go back to the same argument, though, and I'm not making excuses for drunk fans or rude fans. And I know there's behavior that's over the line. However, I always sort of cringe at the hand-wringing we get in these situations because we always talk about golf. You want to be a mainstream sport. Brian Rolapp wants to turn this into a mainstream sports. I'm sorry. That's mainstream sports. It's ugly. Anyone that's ever played a baseball game at Yankee Stadium will tell you they don't treat you kindly there. And I think you could say the same thing about any NFL stadium. They're not nice to you if you're the visiting team. It's just the way it works. And in this particular case, like it or not, Fitz was the visiting team.
Yeah, I certainly understand that. The only reason I ask is it was pretty clearly quick played his pitch shot after Scotty nestled his up close to about a foot.
I was standing on 18 and I didn't hear anything. No, not in that context. No, I didn't. There was nothing.
Yeah, it just seemed like he was almost trying to get ahead of it. I understand your argument. And if you want to be a mainstream sport, this is the sort of thing that you're a competitor, you're going to have to deal with. I guess I just don't really understand the antagonism that Fitz has faced over the past month and a half. Like, no. He's not Ian Poulter. He's not Sergio Garcia. Like, he's not some Ryder Cup villain. I wouldn't even say that he's Roy McIlroy in terms of being sort of a polarizing personality at all. Like, Matt Fitzpatrick is a polite Englishman, and yet he's been hounded the past few times that he's been in contention. I think it's one thing to actively root for a rally to spice up what had been a pretty boring day to that point. I think it's another thing altogether, though, to cheer for another player's downfall. And I just didn't quite understand it, just like I didn't really understand it at the Players' Championship as well. I think good for him for, again, politely putting a hand to an ear, being like, I can't hear you after winning. I thought that was a great way to handle it. And he was classy in victory, just as he was about a month ago at the Players' Championship, but it did not go his way, despite him getting booed when he arrived at the 72nd hole.
I understand it because we're not that far removed from the Ryder Cup, and things can be polarizing in the age that we live in right now. I'm with you 100%. If you were to pick out the 12 players from the European team that maybe you don't like for whatever reason, Fitz is probably going to be 12th on that list. He will give you no reason whatsoever not to like him. He is a hardworking guy. Like, he comes from just a wonderful family. If you were watching the CBS telecast, they were showing pictures of the family on a vacation to Harbortown when he and his brother were just tiny when they fell in love with the golf course. So I guess I don't understand that part, because if you rewind a week, Rory was the favorite at the Masters, and he'll always probably be the favorite going forward. So yeah, it doesn't add up to me entirely.
How about Scotty Scheffler, Rex, the playoff loser? Another rally on the final day, just like he did at the Masters. Not all runner-up finishes are created equal. A week after finishing one shot shy of Roy McIlroy at Augusta National, loses in the playoff. Here, you had an opportunity to talk to Scotty as well. I can only imagine that the tone and tenor of that interview was different after Matt Fitzpatrick played one of the best holes of his life, again, hitting a 4 into 13 feet and making a birdie on that difficult golf hole on Sunday, as opposed to Scotty Scheffler, who's still at 8 feet for par if Fitz had missed his birdie try.
You're absolutely right. Not all playoff losses are created equal. Like, I can imagine a scenario where if Scotty would have missed that interview with Scotty would have gone much different. I would have been maybe flinching a little bit. I'd have been a little bit concerned about how this is going to play out. I'm not going to say he was in a great mood, but in this particular case, I think he acknowledged the fact that it was a great putt on the first playoff hole to actually make it. Like, you always want to convert, but that was a brilliant shot from the fairway in those conditions under that pressure. I think Scotty can acknowledge that. And I think there's a huge amount of respect between those two players. And Scotty talked about it actually on Saturday about, for a guy like Scotty, work ethic is everything. Being prepared is everything. And I don't know that anyone works harder or is more prepared than Matt Fitzpatrick. I mean, he charts every single shot. No one takes a deeper dive in trying to be 1% better every day than Fitz. So, and I think Scotty appreciates that. So that probably cooled it off a little bit. And there's also, and I asked Scotty about this after the fact, he's come close now in consecutive weeks. His game is clearly where he wants it to be right now. And he's going to golf courses where he's had success before. I don't know that there's many golf courses that he hasn't had success at this point in his career with 20 tour victories. However, I think he's confident that he's doing the right thing. This is the Tiger Woods mentality, that the best I can do is just give myself a chance on Sunday. And if you consider the way he started the week, again, we can probably go back and revisit his early rounds, because he wasn't quite Scotty Scheffler to start the week out. And I think a little bit of that probably was fatigue coming off the Masters. But if you can dust off and clean up that Thursday, Friday start, then we're probably not having this conversation.
Yeah, and this is, again, a time of year that Scotty tends to get cooking. And you look at where he is at this point this year, as opposed to where he was last year from a strokes gain perspective, it's night and day difference. He is in such a better spot this year, even if he only has one victory to show for it at this point. I think what has been blatantly obvious over these past couple weeks, first the Masters, now the RBC Heritage, that I really admire and appreciate about Scotty Scheffler is his competitiveness. And I know that that's a weird trait to really love and admire and respect, but like, Tiger Woods had a flair for the moment and a flair for the dramatic. Phil Mickelson took on risky shots. Jordan Spieth was a nonstop thrill ride. Roy McIlroy, his talent and his power is so tantalizing, like you just get sucked up in his vortex. Scotty's traits, I think, are harder to unearth, or they're maybe not so obvious, or they're not so apparent to the naked eye. Like, he just doesn't give up. He never quits. He just keeps plotting and working and efforting and fighting. And you look at his 2026 season. Yes, he won the American Express in his first start of 2026. Then he, remember, had right that 2 month period of really struggling out of the gates in the first rounds. Yeah. He still, Rex, battled back to have a couple of top five finishes. You look at what he was doing last week at the Masters. He was 12 back at the halfway point. Nearly runs down Roy McIlroy, ends up finishing just a shot shy. Here at the RBC Heritage, goes 11 under on the weekend. Again, even without being completely in full flight from a ball striking standpoint, he had his worst putting day of the week on Sunday as well at Harbortown. Even without his best stuff, he just keeps fighting, just keeps competing. I think that's one of the things that has been obvious the past couple of weeks and 2026 as well for Scottie Scheffler. All right, that's a wrap on the PGA Tour stuff. Coming up after this break, we are going to have a deep dive on the week that was at LIV Golf. The rumors, the reports, and the future uncertainty. Rex and I will unpack it all after this break. All right, Rex, there have been setbacks for LIV Golf before. You think back to them being denied official World Golf ranking points or having little access to majors, getting rebuffed by some of the biggest names in the sport. But it's hard to imagine a worse week for LIV Golf than what unfolded over the past 7 days. We already on this podcast went through some of the widespread reporting that happened last Wednesday with the Saudi Public Investment Fund. According to the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Financial Times, being on the verge of pulling its funding for LIV Golf at the end of the 2026 season. But then on Thursday, we had a disastrous media blitz for LIV CEO Scott O'Neill. Now that we've had a couple days to unpack all of this LIV drama, which is, again, started all the way back in 2022, how do you feel about it?
I don't know that we have any more definitive answers than what the conversation you and I had on Wednesday. And certainly there was a lot of unknowns on that day. I think going forward, and again, you talked about the media blitz that Scott O'Neill, the CEO of LIV Golf, went through. And I think there's one specific quote. He did an interview with Oliver Wilson. He's a friend of ours. He's a very good journalist. He's a former player, but I have a lot of respect for Ollie. And during that interview, he was asked about the future of LIV Golf. And this was on TNT Sports UK. And the quote was, and trust me, I don't like to read, but I'm going to go ahead and do this. Quote, "The reality is you're funded through the season and then you work like crazy to create business and a business plan to keep us going. But that's not different than any other private equity business in the history of mankind. I don't want to put words in anyone's mouth, but you don't have to read between those lines to figure out what's going on. That the public investment fund is stepping away at the end of this year. I think that's safe based on the reporting we've seen and based on that quote, based on all the rumors that are swirling around. And if you look at the reporting, it's the Financial Times, it's the New York Times, it's the Wall Street Journal. These are respected organizations. Maybe one of them gets it wrong. All three of them don't get it wrong. And so at this point, you turn the page to essentially what Scott O'Neill says in that clip, which, by the way, that interview was taken off the internet somehow and it was re-racked and that quote didn't come back up on the back end. So we can get into how messy they have handled this.
Yes. Like, what are we doing here? This is the internet. This is 2026. And this is the same person in Scott O'Neill who was just railing about unnamed sources without actually dismissing any of the reporting that had happened over those 4 or 5 days. In fact, the only thing he did was confirm it, which was, again, one of your reports on Golf Central on Wednesday night, that LIV Golf was fully funded through the rest of the 2026 season. That's what Scott O'Neill said in that interview. Again, LIV can sort of have some sort of erasing of the past or what he said. That's exactly what happened. It was posted, taken down, removed, and reposted without that very damning admission in it.
And I'm going to try here, and it's not going to work out. I know it's not, but you and I both are going to get absolutely destroyed by the bots who will come after us inevitably, and we're going to get into that later in the show. But what's going on here, if you have private equity, and that's what the public investment fund is, to be clear, that's what SSG is as well. So the PGA Tour has their own burden on this, and private equity wants a return on their investment. And I think that's where we've been when it comes to LIV Golf the last 3 years. At what point do they realize that there is not either enough return or there's not enough hope for a return in the future? And so clearly they're walking away. But in this situation, and I'm coming to Scott O'Neill's defense here, as the CEO of this company, you can't just go public and be like, yep, they're cutting bait at the end of this year. We have to find someone new. Instead, you have to use essentially the second half of their season, because this is the 6 of 14 events, to prove to another private equity
that this is worth investing in. And maybe he pulls it off. To be fair, the product has not caught on in the United States. I don't think I'm saying anything that hasn't already been said before and doesn't feel like it's already fact. Internationally, they have some traction. So if he can find a way to convince someone that, yes, what we're doing internationally can work, I think you can see a version of Live Golf living on. However, that's never going to have the deep pockets that Piff had, nor is it going to have what it was described to me as patient money. They were in it for the long haul. So those two things are going to be difficult to reconcile. But I have a hard time wrapping around my mind around the reports that Live Golf is over, because I don't know if that's necessarily the case. The public investment fund is done with Live Golf. That much is clear.
But when you look at the investment that the Saudi Piff has made into Live Golf, I can see how generous interpretation of this is that this entire enterprise is dead, unless there are some outside investors who want to pick up a product that has already torched through $5 billion with little to show for it. And that's you and fair. I talked about it on the midweek episode last week, where I actually thought that there was at least a semblance of momentum for Live Golf in 2026. You look at the sponsorship is up. You look at the ticket sales are up. You've had some big name winners, John Rahm, Bryson DeChambeau, even Anthony Kim back from the dead. At least it felt like things were moving in the right direction. But this was such a massive step back with the public acknowledgement that this tent might be folding up unless we get some outside help. And this was the first week of the Scott O'Neill era, in my opinion, where it felt very Greg Norman-esque, with a lot of the unfounded bombast and the bluster and some of the complaining and lashing out at media organizations and sort of the unfair treatment. That was the hallmark of the Greg Norman era at Liv. And this was the first time that Scott O'Neill sort of veered into that territory as well. It's pretty clear, Rex, that what the Saudi Piff is doing, and it's pretty obvious with some of their other moves that they've made, including the soccer team, the Tom Brady flag football venture, they are just shifting their priorities. And that's their prerogative. But if the spigot gets turned off, Liv Golf is in trouble. And so my question at this point is what are your outstanding questions? Because we're midway through the 2026 Live Golf season. This is year four, year five, depending on when you start the official clock and when the official Live Golf started. What sort of outstanding questions do you have at this point as it relates to the future? And one of them can't be, is this thing about to die?
No, because I'm not willing to take that step. I can see why people are going to make that leap. And I perfectly understand it, because you're right. You're never going to find those types of deep pockets. We all knew this was irrational. That's Shea Monahan's words, not mine. I think the biggest question I have going forward is, can a version of Liv Golf be sustained? Can they find a way to sort of bottle that success that they've had internationally and move it forward? The problem is, you're not going to have your biggest marquee names along for the ride anymore. You won't be able to play Bryson DeChambeau, whatever outrageous sum he was negotiating for. You probably won't be able to re-sign a John Rahm. You won't be able to re-sign any of those big names. And I think Scott O'Neill alluded to that in the TNT interview I just referenced. He talked about going a little bit younger, trying to be a little bit more grassroots. I've argued all along, and people who are a lot smarter than me have backed this up, that if they were smart, Liv Golf would have gone after all of the young players. If you were to start picking off the young college players one at a time, eventually the PGA Tour would have gotten hurt by that. Because eventually the next Jordan Spieth doesn't work up the pipeline. The next Scottie Scheffler doesn't work up the pipeline. So I can see in a universe them going forward. I know it doesn't look anything like it looks now. And so my question would be, what version could work? What possible scaled back international younger version could possibly hold the ship?
Yeah, because Scott O'Neill had previously mentioned in interviews this year that Live Golf was still 5 to 10 years away from profitability. And so if you're an outside vendor, you are taking on an enormous risk to try and turn this thing around. And so the outstanding questions that I have are, how are you going to pay Bryson DeChambeau, who again is going to be seeking a nine-figure deal to return to this league? How are you going to support $30 million purses? Which again, yes, that has lifted up PGA Tour purses as well. We mentioned on the midweek episode, this is probably unsustainable for the PGA Tour as well. The RBC Heritage was a $20 million signature event back in 2021, the year before Liv launched. It was a $7.5 million purse. some sort of market correction is likely coming to the PGA Tour as well. You mentioned sort of going the younger route or going the international route. And that was one thing that Scott O'Neill had mentioned with Arlo White on the tournament broadcast as well, when it wasn't offline for a couple hours in the opening round, of if you are an American who wants to stay home, this is not going to be for you. You want to have to try new things. You want to have to be on the road. You have to want to be away from your family. How are you going to convince international and young players, particularly Americans, who again would have some of the cachet through the college golf system, to take that leap and take that route when you have reduced world ranking points, when you still have limited access to the major championships? There was also, Rex, the mention of focusing, Scott O'Neill called it a blending of the national opens and the LIV Golf product. And look, that seems to have worked pretty well. I would argue that LIV Adelaide was a bigger smash than the Australian Open. You look at what happened in South Africa. The LIV event there about a month and a half ago was a bigger smash than the South African Open on the DP World Tour. It can work. Singapore is another example as well. But how are you going to focus almost exclusively on national opens and trying to target those underserved, underappreciated markets when almost all of those actual national opens are currently occupied by the DP World Tour? Is that going to involve some sort of partnership with the European Tour, which again also has an alliance strategically with the PGA Tour? That's very messy as well. And I think the big outstanding question at this point, Rex, is are players going to jump ship? We already have two pathways that have at least been proven. And look, some of the rules and the regulations can be rewritten by either Brian Rolapp or the PGA Tour Policy Board. But right now, the two pathways that we know was the returning member program, which again, Brooks Koepka was the only one of those players, Cam Smith, Bryson DeChambeau, John Rahm, the others who were at least offered to come back to the PGA Tour. That was a very narrow pathway for a specific set of players. But you also have the Patrick Reed route, who decided not to rejoin LIV for the 2026 season, and he's now serving what amounts to a one-year suspension from the date of his last LIV event. So Patrick Reed can begin playing PGA Tour events as early as this fall. Knowing that at least those two pathways have been established, if you are a David Puig, if you're a Jose Le Ballester, do you start thinking about your future? Do you start looking to the DP World Tour? Do you start, you know, making plans for Q School and trying to get on the PGA Tour that way? That's sort of an outstanding question as well, is if this thing actually does fold, and I think we had a couple caveats there that it might not necessarily do so, what sort of options do you have, and when do these players start looking ahead?
Well, and that was kind of why I wanted to talk to Maverick McNealy today after his round at RBC Heritage. Again, a member of the policy board. And his comment to me was, the rules and regs are already in place. Like, you can already see the pathway, and Patrick Reed is taking that pathway. And as you pointed out, I'm going to address that pathway first, because the first one, as you pointed out, the returning member program is a little bit more interesting to me. It is clear cut. And I think the actual quote from Mav said, most of the players from LIV will have to take this pathway because they don't have any status on the PGA Tour. So you're talking about either Q School, you're talking about doing it on the DP World Tour like P. Reed has done, or the Korn Ferry Tour, or some combination of all of those. The vast majority of players coming from LIV Golf will have to do it that way. The only other option would be the returning member program, as you pointed out. But that was a very narrow list of players. Only four players were in that category with a deadline. It was a one-time deal. And from what I was told, this was not setting a precedent. So actually, I'm going to be surprised if they reinstitute a returning member program. And it would only be for a Bryson, a John Rahm, or Cam Smith, for certainly fell in under that category. Only because Brian Rolapp was able to sell it to the membership, because this is what's best for the tour. And Brooks Koepka was paying a very high price. He paid $5 million. He wasn't exempt into the signature events. He was sitting on a bench on Thursday morning at dawn waiting to get in at the first alternate here at Harbortown. By the way, he didn't get in. He sat on that bench all day long, didn't get into it. I don't see John Rahm doing it. That's another conversation. I think every player on the PGA Tour was fine with that, because Brooks took the commitment to sit on that bench. That's the metaphorical, perfect way to pointing this out. However, he also made all of the other fields better. He's in the field this week in New Orleans. He's playing alongside Shane Lowry. He played the Cognizant. He's only making these other events, not signature events, better on his way up the ladder.
That's fantastic. I think everybody bought into the idea. This was a good idea. I don't know that they would do it this time around. I think a second bite at the apple would cause a big problem.
And those two players in particular, Cam Smith is a little bit different. He loves Liv. He loves the life that he has carved out for him, and good for him. John Rahm, though, bolted for Liv Golf mere months after the framework agreement. Essentially, that's going to rub players the wrong way as well. This is a player who very easily could have stayed loyal to the PGA Tour, and instead think he only served to deepen the wounds of golf's civil war. Bryce DeChambeau, of course, back in 2022 was part of that original lawsuit of the 11 players who sued the PGA Tour for anti-competitive practices as well. So they are a little bit of a different case than Brooks Koepka, who by and large kept his mouth shut and was respectful upon his departure. Also keep in mind that happened before the start of the LIV Golf season. I'm not a lawyer. This might be speculation, but offering that program, potentially breaking up contracts, gets a little bit messy as well. Sausage fingers up, which means it's your turn.
No, it means that you make a really good point, is what this means, because I think the PGA Tour is going to be exceedingly careful of not tampering at all, because that lawsuit, that legal pendulum swings both ways. If you remember, the PGA Tour sued LIV Golf for tampering players to pull them over early in this process. The PGA Tour doesn't want to get anywhere close to that line. So what they're going to do, and if you remember correctly, it has been said, I don't know, by my own estimates, about a gazillion times that Brooks Koepka reached out to the PGA Tour, first through Tiger Woods, and then eventually Brian Rolapp, and got the ball rolling. It'll be the same thing for every other single player, because the tour is going to be very careful. I think the other element to this, and I think we did touch on this on Wednesday, is when players decide, and I think this will happen over the next few weeks, if not days, that, okay, the end may be near for LIV Golf. At what point do I cut bait and decide I just want to get the clock rolling? Because essentially it's a one-year suspension. So if you're a player, like, and you pointed out a couple, I guess I would use Tom McKibben as an example as well, Michael Assasso, even Joaquin Niemann, perhaps, as an example. If they don't have contracts, and that's a big if, because we don't know exactly what their commitment is to LIV Golf, you're almost thinking to yourself, if I cut bait now, if I walk away now, my clock starts right now, which means I would be eligible for PGA Tour events starting at the end of next spring. That's much better than playing the string out and essentially having to wait around a year like Patrick Reed has. And like it worked out for Patrick Reed. He won twice on the DP World Tour. He can stay sharp, play as many events as he wants in Europe. And then when the fall rolls around, he can pick up where he left off. I don't know that the other players are counting on that. So what I think we all need to watch for at this point, does someone break ranks? Does someone decide that, yep, I want to get on that clock right now and get back to the PGA Tour sooner rather than later?
And look, it's a competitive decision, as you mentioned, with the pathways. It's also a financial decision. LIV Golf, per Scott O'Neill, is still fully funded for the remainder of the season. They are in line, if you're a good player on LIV, to make a boatload of money for the remainder of 2026. But do you start looking at your future? That's going to be very, very interesting. That's a great segue, Rex, because besides Scott O'Neill and his media blustering, there actually was two pretty noteworthy developments. John Rahm won at Chapultepec in dominating fashion, and Bryson DeChambeau withdrew, citing wrist soreness before the final round. Which of those two news developments is newsworthier to you?
John Rahm winning. And this is his second win on LIV Golf this year. I think a lot of people, for good reason, fixated on John Rahm last week. He did not have his best week at the Masters. I picked him.
You picked him
to win for a lot of different reasons. I think statistically, you felt like he matched up perfectly for that golf course. He's won there before, but I finally felt like LIV Golf going to 72 holes this season, him getting the victory earlier in the year, I think everything was moving in the direction that he was the one player out of the four or five or six that you would have considered last week that I couldn't find a reason not to pick other than, well, he might just play like crap. And my pick was going to go in the dumpster, and that's it. What ended up happening. That one to me is more compelling, because anytime a player like John Rahm is coming off a week like he had, the disappointment was probably going to be high. And he did have some interesting things to say on Sunday before he left the Masters about he feels like he figured some things out. He feels like he knows what he did wrong. He feels like when the golf course is in the condition it was last week, firm, fast, no rain whatsoever, that he needs to mix some things up. Now, that all makes sense to me because the game is clearly still there. Now, the speculation when it comes to Bryson, I get where you're going with this. Are we going to see the blue flu? Is he going to decide that, you know what,
Maybe I'm just not going to out and quit. He has a contract through the end of this year, but I'm going to come up with an injury every week and I'm just not going to play LIV Golf anymore. That's an interesting conversation, other than he would probably have to skip the majors in between too. And I don't know if he would do that.
That's why when you talk about compelling, you talk about intriguing, it's Bryson DeChambeau. John Rahm only reinforced that he is so clearly the head of this league, the head of this class. And at least to this point, since he bolted for LIV at the end of 2023, he drops down a level when it matters most. So yes, does it heighten intrigue and heighten interest for the PGA Championship to see if John Rahm can redeem himself, if he can play the type of golf he's done on LIV Golf? Absolutely. But Bryson's the interesting one because now he has wrist soreness. He said he's, quote, hopeful to play in Virginia in a couple weeks. We just had a conversation of how motivated are these guys going to be to support a product that at this point, if LIV Golf is not dead, it's at least on life support. It's at least in hospice care. How motivated are the big stars going to be to support it? I sort of liken this potential situation. Again, this is just potential. We just learned about Bryson DeChambeau injuring his wrist a couple of hours ago. If it's a lost season for an NFL team and you all of a sudden you tweak your hamstring in week 14, do you just sort of shut it down and look ahead to the 2027 season? It's a contract year for Bryson DeChambeau. Who knows what the future holds for him again? Bryson DeChambeau wrist soreness, hopeful to play in a couple weeks with the PGA Championship after the LIV event in Virginia. All right, coming up after this break, you guys were great, not surprisingly, with some of the listener questions, voices in the crowd, plus Rex's trip around the patch coming up next. All right, folks, it's time for the best part of the program, voices in the crowd, hearing from you in the YouTube comment section or our Twitter accounts. This one from another sorry guy, Rex. Do you think that Harbortown is one of those courses that you could tweak to make it U.S. Open ready?
I don't think so. I don't think it could become a U.S. Open venue because I don't think it would work with rough. And that's the only thing. If you kept it as is and you played it this time of year, this week was a perfect example. It was firm. It was fast. I think everyone loved it. And it was a very difficult test, but you can't back it up. Like, it's maxed out when it comes to yardage. It's very confined. And I think if you put rough in there, it would change the dynamic of the golf course too much.
Perfect PGA Tour venue, not buying it as a U.S. Open venue. Of course, that would also be in June. God, the Bermuda would be difficult. God, it would be hot. Mosquitoes, humidity, just sweating through my shirt.
Not mosquitoes, sand nets.
Yeah, whatever. Whatever, it's going to be very, very unpleasant. How about this one, Rex? This is an interesting question for Bradley Suter, who said, John Rahm won't pay the $3 million reported fine to rejoin the European Tour. What makes you think he would pay $5 million plus to get back on the PGA Tour?
Brad, you see me. You see exactly what I was trying to say on Wednesday's podcast. That's exactly what I was pointing out. If he doesn't like the deal from the European Tour, how in the world is he ever going to accept what Brooks Koepka accepted? It isn't going to happen. Again, I keep falling back on this metaphor, but do you think John Rahm would have been sitting on that porch Thursday morning and all day long waiting to get a tee time as a first alternate? Not going to happen.
I know, but there's many PGA Tour players who would like to see John Rahm with hat in hand apologizing for deepening golf civil war and that sort of scenario. The only reason why I could see this playing out, Rex, because he might not have a choice. He might not have a choice but to pay fines to rejoin the DP World Tour or the PGA Tour to pay competitive golf in between the major championship starts, which again, he's still exempt for the next couple of years. How about this one from West Sighted, who said, is this all of the LIV drama? Is that what made Sergio Garcia lose his mind at the Masters?
Sure. I'll go for it. What made him lose his mind for the two decades before that? Sergio Garcia has always been a petulant player. I mean, his history is really clear on this front. I was a little surprised that not only did he do it at the Masters, but then we had a long conversation on Sunday during Live From about an exchange that Scottie Scheffler had with a reporter. And I think you and I were under the same mindset that, yes, it wasn't the best exchange, but that is not who Scottie Scheffler is. He's not unprofessional. I think that was in a playful moment. I would look at that and say that Scottie Scheffler should be ashamed of that. I think you and I both are in the same mindset. However, I took the whole transcript from Sergio's exchange with reporters on Sunday after his round, and I sent that to the producers who wanted us to have a conversation. And my point was, that's petulant and that's unprofessional.
He was grumpy pre-tournament. He was grumpy during the tournament. He was grumpy at the conclusion of the tournament. Also, if you go back and read the LIV transcripts from this year, he's been grumpy all season. No, I do not think Sergio Garcia was tipped off about what was happening with the future of LIV Golf. I think that's just who he is. This one, Rex, is personal from Isaac, who said, Trevor, stay off social media and mow the lawn. Trevor, of course, is a pseudonym we have for your son. What say you?
Well, first things first, at YoungCell14, and he does not speak for me. That's my son. He is Cole Hoggard. We call him Trevor on the podcast because he looks like Trevor Lawrence. And we ran into a situation this week, as I referenced earlier, that social media was not kind to either one of us this week. And it has everything to do with Live Golf, and it's a very polarizing conversation. And it may or may not be bots. I don't know. I don't particularly care. But Trevor has done this before on Instagram, where he's seen something that's said about me and doesn't like it and pops back. And I'm not on Instagram, so I don't care. Him doing it on Twitter this week, or X, created some big issues because my son doesn't seem to have a filter. So I did have to tell him to stop it. Cut it out, and you're right. He needs to mow the lawn because I've been gone for 2 weeks, and by all accounts, it is awful.
My dad used to do that. He used to go into the Twitter comment section, and he was fighting. He'd take out a sword and trying to chop down everybody. My wife no longer cares. She just laughs. There was a very homophobic meme that came out with an AI-generated background. This is what my background looks like. There's a lot of Georgia stuff. There's a lot of Jaguar stuff. Like, this is exactly what it looks like. Whatever you see on social media is not true. Didn't like it. Don't stand for it. Please do not do that. Rex, you had an opportunity to play golf last week in Augusta at the Patch, the Reed on Muni. How'd you play? How'd you like it?
Played on Monday with super producer Andrew Bradley, and I'd heard a lot of things about this. And look, this was the Patch. It was not it's your typical Muni. It was named the Patch, and that was not an affectionate name from what all accounts is what I heard. And Augusta National stepped in with the community to really rebuild it. And it's a phenomenal place. You and I have become friends with a lot of folks in the Augusta community. And this is going to change the community because not only did they redo the golf course, and it's going to be cheap, affordable golf for people in the community. What you're looking at, that's the Learning Center. And you can see the hitting bays, and the range is phenomenal. You can see the big green. There is going to be a first tee program right next to it, I believe, is the building you're looking at. Tiger Woods is going to create one of his learning labs on property. There's a 9-hole course for kids called The Loop. I'm telling you, this is the standard. Now, I don't know that every community could do it, but what Augusta did here is really special.
Yeah, I'd love to see that. I'm sure you shot one of your career best rounds, no doubt, in the low 90s, if not the upper 80s. I also, Rex, wanted to give a special shout out to avid golf fan Aaron Edith. She drew this painting for my birthday. I turned 39 during Masters Week. My wife helped commission this. That is us on the set of Live from the Masters. That's me on the left, that's you in the middle, and that is the Steve Sands Notes. We always love chopping it up with him at Augusta National. Very special painting. Aaron did an amazing job. Find her on Instagram. She has a bunch of golf portraits and is very, very good at her job. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Trail Podcast with Rex and Lav. We'll be back in the middle of the week to do a preview of the Zurich Classic and any other news that drops in the world of golf. Thanks for listening. Thanks for support. Talk to you guys in a couple of days.